Okay. So today on the Loopcast, I have Bob Gourley, who works for CTO Vision and is generally, a big name in big data. And so today in our conversation, we're going to talk about big data. So it's a little background. It's, it's something that we hear a lot about, and it's in the media, and it's really a catchphrase, not a catchphrase, but something that, has garnered a lot of attention in the last couple of years. So hopefully our conversation will sort of try to understand what is big data. So my first question is, give us a history of big data. Why is the focus, on big data now, when we've, up to now we've had, huge servers and, the ability to store a lot of data onto one sort of system.
Right. So that's a good question. And first, I should say, what does big data mean? And it's getting to the point where it's like the old story of the five blind men and the elephant. And what that elephant meant to each of those five blind men was a different thing. And in the world of big data, we're finding that term means different things to just about anybody who encounters the term. And there's a danger there because now the marketing departments of every IT company in the world have glommed onto that big data term and are starting to say, I do big data and I've always done big data forever. And user organizations have all said, well, I've worked with data forever. I've always done big data. So there's a danger that the term is losing its meaning a little bit. Let me tell you my perspective as a technologist, but I'll just say right up front, it's not the only perspective. It's just mine. I believe the term is most useful when it compels you to think differently and think bigger than what you currently do. So, a layman's definition of the term big data might be more data than your current infrastructure can handle. More data than you can currently make sense of or ask questions of. On the smallest scale, your home computer may have maybe a terabyte of information on it, and maybe that's just right. That's not big data for you because you can make sense of all that. But maybe if you had 2 terabytes worth of video and photos and emails, that would be too much and you would need a new solution. And then in enterprises, the very largest data intensive enterprises like the National Security Agency or Department of Homeland Security, they're dealing with petabytes of information. And to them, their big challenge is, that kind of big data problem. How do you make sense over petabytes? To smaller organizations, and a government example might be a smaller agency or a company might be, maybe a company with just a few hundred people. They may have a big data problem that's much smaller. So I'm kind of characterizing it in data sizes, but there's an even better way to characterize it. First, let me just say layman's definition of big data, more data than you can currently make sense of. So you got to change your approach. As a technologist, we like more specific definitions, and I like to say it's the lessons that were learned by the e-commerce community that are now being applied elsewhere. Specifically, it's the lessons learned by Google when they decided to index the entire internet. Never done successfully before. They did it in a way that allowed them to search it fast and return results fast. And it required new processes and procedures. They then wrote those up in a couple very famous open documents that the whole community could read, on a concept called MapReduce and another concept called Bigtable. That allowed the open source community, led by a guy named Doug Cutting, to create something called Hadoop. And Hadoop is a new software framework. So whenever I, as a technologist, hear the term big data, I think, Doug Cutting and Hadoop. And that's my perspective. So many other people would push back, and I understand those other views. Like I mentioned, the five guys and the elephant. Other people might say, no, big data doesn't mean you have to have Hadoop. Big data is how you store it and retrieve it, or big data is the pipes that you move it through. And but for me, I think those lessons from the e-commerce world now being used in other enterprises, and Hadoop is an important piece of that. Sorry, did I ramble a little bit?
No, it's that's a perfect answer. And I think if we were to take that story and sort of, break it down into trends, it seems like, the point you made was, the decreasing cost of memory. So, the idea that, a normal consumer could have a terabyte hard drive, whereas a commerce solution could have a petabyte. And, also in terms of processing speeds. But I mean, sort of away from the hardware, I mean, what else are there other trends besides, the hardware? I mean, are there trends in software and sort of, conceptual trends that have sort of led us to, big data? I mean, you mentioned that, Google, in their attempt to sort of index the internet, they took it, created whole new processes and whole new sort of functions. I mean,
Right.
what else, sort of, away from the hardware and more into the software and more into the sort of how we perceive data or how we understand data.
Well, you remind me of a really good point. A few months ago, I was at an event. It was a meetup to talk about big data and solutions, and we got some demos by some of the tech firms in the ecosystem here, and I gave my same comment about, as a technologist, how I view big data. And one of the guys introduced himself and said he's a mathematician with a master's degree in statistics. And he's wondering if big data is only about the software and storing and analyzing the data. Isn't there a role for the algorithms and the mathematics behind it? And that, of course, made the light go off in my head saying, yes. Back to that analogy of the five guys and the elephant, I'm looking at things from a technology viewpoint, and really the mathematicians and statisticians and people who develop the algorithms are the real, I mean, really, really playing an important role in making sense over this stuff. And then the people who transform those ideas and algorithms into software, the software coders, are also an important part of this. So it's a someone needs to take the holistic view of the whole thing, and it's always an eye-opening, mind-expanding experience for me to have conversations with folks from other domains. That said, I enjoy focusing in on the technology. I'm a CTO, and that's what I do, and I'm very happy to say that it's important to learn what the technology can do. The true concept needs to bring in people from all the disciplines to make sense over the data.
Okay, that was a really good history. Let's sort of switch to the science of big data. So, how does, how does sort of Google's Big Table sort of, how is that different than sort of Facebook's Cassandra and sort of, Amazon's, I'm guessing, whatever they call their sort of search function. The name escapes me for now, but, how do we describe, what do we, from a scientific standpoint, what can we tease out from, Big Table, Cassandra, and these other sort of, e-commerce deployments of or usage of big data? I mean, is there a textbook sort of we can refer to, or is it, really dependent on the company and the organization?
The answer to that is clearly a it depends. I'm going to give you a very generic kind of response, and that is a lot of the difference is how the data is indexed. When it's like a big table type index, you're going to put a processor down by the data, and be able to work on the data separately wherever it is. Some solutions needed to grow to the point where you could not just build a single index. You had to have a distributed index. So they would scale in a limitless way, a horizontally scalable way. And that's the modern web scale databases. And that movement has just begun. I'd say it begun right around 2009 is when it took off. And there are several good overviews of this NoSQL world, but the community is developing so fast. But to summarize, there's distributed and non-distributed. Distributed databases are the ones that partition everything in a scalable way, and that includes Amazon. You know, they have Dynamo is their key one. You can buy something similar that's from the open source community called RIAC. Others include MongoDB, which is a easily scales incredibly large. Cassandra and Bigtable are in that same kind of category, HBase. But there's the non-distributed database where something is just going to be right on your client or right in your server, and those play an important role too. Tyrant is one of them, Memcache, DB, Amazon even provides one like this. And how you pick between a distributed versus non-distributed database and which one of the distributed ones you pick depends on things like how much data do you have and how quickly does it change and how quickly do you need to be able to search it, but also the type of the data. For example, are you going to be creating records that are like an item at Walmart, so it's an inventory thing where there's a lot of items and a little bit of information on each item, or are you creating records where there's not many items, but a huge amount of data per item? Depending on your answers to that, you'll decide your data model. And the common way that data folks look at data models are you're either going to have a key value store, a document store, or a column store. And we write about these on CTO Vision, and I think sometimes we assume that everybody's tracking us as we talk about document store, column store, key value store, and it may help if I pause and maybe give some examples of what those things are.
So, I mean, this, it comes up in advertising. I mean, it seems like with Google, you know, the push to sort of monetize and to sort of bring in money outside of, you know, stock or, you know, and outside investments. I mean, sort of, you know, that seems to be the most famous and most sort of obvious to the Loopcast's listeners, but sort of give us, you know, how else is, you know, big data, how is it used in, you know, other applications? I mean, you know, in my own sort of like coding experience, I started messing with Google Maps API, and it was very, you know, I wouldn't say that it was a smooth experience, but definitely there was enough data and enough sort of, you know, interaction between me and the individual and, you know, this big data set that it was, you know, I could sort of shape and model what I needed to. But I mean, beyond the issue of, you know, advertising in an API, what else, you know, give us some sort of non-obvious examples, you know, besides, you know, searching and sort of, you know, non-obvious.
Yeah. So one way that I think most of us use this without perhaps thinking about it is when we use LinkedIn and you open up LinkedIn and it suggests some folks that you might want to connect with, and that is generated and presented to you rapidly, and it's a very smart and useful feature for folks. And that kind of creation of information is, you know, it couldn't be done without these new big data approaches. Or in Twitter, if you make an update and it's immediately available to anyone who's following you and anyone who does a search or looks for you and even isn't following you, those kind of big data solutions are in use by people who don't need to understand the technology at all. And so I think what we as planners and managers and designers ought to be thinking about is the use cases. So if I'm building a new system, it hasn't existed before, it's always helpful to think, well, who has built similar systems in other places that may be of use? So you go through your notes or read your blogs and see who has built something that is going to be similar to what I need. And then what data system did they use? For example, if you want to manage inventory and you have a large amount of inventory and a huge number of stores, you probably don't turn to Facebook first. You probably look and see what Best Buy is doing. And if you ask, they'll probably say, well, we needed something that was close to what Amazon was doing, so we picked Rayak or MongoDB. And so it's always helpful to have networks of technologists that can steer you in the right place for your right use case.
So let's sort of switch gears a little and let's talk about sort of the security implications of big data. So I think you've presented a very sort of interesting, the science and the sort of the use. I'm curious if we could just, put our white hats on or black hats or gray hats, whatever color hats, you wear, and sort of discuss, how do you My first question from a security perspective is, how do you secure the data being used? Do you, from not necessarily being stolen, but sort of being manipulated, or, is this something that, let me, take a step back. Is this something people are thinking about as, data sets are constructed and sort of, put into, into the, the data is put into the software? I mean, is this something that, is being thought about?
Yeah, so let's talk about that, and also I'd like to expand my response and talk about ethics a little bit too, because it's all kind of related. One, in the first use of these kind of capabilities, like Google when they built their system, and then when the papers they wrote that Doug Cutting turned into the Hadoop and Hadoop framework. Those early uses were designed to be inside enterprises where the way you secure it is you put it in a data center and surround that with guards and don't let anybody in. And that's how you secure it. And then you monitor who's interacting with that data. So the data was not designed to be encrypted on the servers. Now, lots more has been written in to secure that kind of data into the like Apache Hadoop framework. One thing that was written in early was an ability to manage it using capabilities like Cloudera's distribution of Hadoop as management tools. And that lets you do things like audit or say, here's who's authorized to change the management of the system. A malicious person, unfortunately, if they are inside your network and in your data center, could do damage to that data. And since it's currently stored in an unclassified way, a malicious person could steal your hard drives or tap into them in some other way and get that data. So that's bad. And people have been thinking about that challenge. And also, people could maliciously, even with those management tools, if they were really a savvy computer scientist, could maliciously get around and manipulate data. So that's bad too. So things have been designed to mitigate that. There is the strict auditing, the authentication of users, and then in some cases, you can actually get capabilities that encrypt some of the data and protect some of the rows. That always gets hard. Every solution I've seen that adds encryption into these solutions introduces three new vulnerabilities for every one that it corrects. It really begins to get complicated. Because every time you think encryption, you have to think key management. And if you have 1,000 node clusters and you say, I'm going to encrypt something on 1,000 nodes, you got to move 1,000 keys around. And it just becomes more and more complex and complicated. So right now, the way you secure these things is by securing your network and building enclaves and keeping the data protected that way. And that's not the only way. There's also some solutions like Accumulo, which is in use in the government, which adds new layers of security into these kind of systems. I wanted to mention the ethics, too, of this, because that's another dimension that's kind of related to security. Very interesting ethics challenges and dilemmas are coming up because people are bringing more and more data together. Some of the most interesting ones are in the commercial world, where people bring maybe anonymized data together, but they bring so much of it together, it loses its anonymity, and therefore you lose a bit of your privacy. There's case after case of people feeling some company is behaving in a very creepy way because they know so much about you. They know exactly what to market to you. And those are ethics dilemmas. And then there's all of us with our, in the United States anyway, with this strong desire for privacy and expectation that our government is not going to be snooping on us. And then the incidental collection of information by the government on us, all that is, I think, very well managed. And we should, from my observation, be proud of our government and how the technologists there try to protect our privacy. But as they build bigger and bigger data sets, what happens when it gets out of control? And not just our federal government, but the state government. There's the South Carolina had this major breach of their many of their records, where people's personal identifiable information, including social security numbers, was compromised because of hacks into state-run systems. To me, that is it's a security violation. But there's also an ethics issue there. I think it was ethically wrong for the state to leave information in an unencrypted way like that. So when it was stolen, it puts their citizens at risk.
So let's you brought up a bunch of great topics on sort of ethics. I'm curious then, it seems like there's three layers that we have to deal with then. Because it seems like the individual's relationship with private companies. So, your terms of, terms of service that you consent to for Facebook, Twitter, or Amazon. And then, there's another layer of, the state agency. So Kansas, Tennessee, Florida, Virginia, and then another layer, which would be the federal government. So if we could we focus on Facebook a little? I mean, it seems, at the private level, how do you build privacy, into this service? I mean, it seems like, I was making a joke with Alex that, I think the creepiest service available is Amazon. And it's because, when I'm looking at books on Amazon, the strip at the bottom, based on your past purchases, you might enjoy these books. It seems almost, it's sort of creepy because it's reading through, all the purchases I've made, which, I consent to that creepiness because, it does yield good books and good information. But, with Facebook, the facial recognition technology that seems to, take you, look at your picture, identify a face, and then sort of say, do you want to, tag it, as, whomever. But, as a technologist, how do you approach privacy in the, in the private sector, when you're dealing with Facebook, Amazon, Twitter, Netflix, even, what's the approach there? Like, what is the debate and the give and take between, a developer, a company, and then, the individual?
Yeah, great question. There's a guy, Scott McNeely, very famously said, privacy is dead. Get over it. And he said that back in the 1990s. And guys like me, I want to push back and say, no, privacy's not dead. I expect it. I demand it. But still, he makes a good point that a lot of times we assume things should be private when actually they're not. And even with this, even what all of us want, maybe we just want it, but we're not going to get it. I'm trying to think of the right analogy here, but You know, you have a right to privacy, but you do not have a right to invisibility. And if you opt into things like Amazon and you buy through them and you use your real name and you pay them with your own money, you're volunteering to do that. And if you're in Facebook, you know, if you're not in Facebook, something's wrong with you and you're weird and you're an outcast, so you got to be in Facebook. I mean, generally, it's who's not in Facebook? So it's
true.
Almost becoming mandatory. It's like, who doesn't have a telephone? You have electricity in your house, you have a telephone, you have plumbing, so you're going to be in Facebook too. So and part of it is, you know, it's becoming a mandatory part of modern life, but it's a commercial service. You opt into it, you give them away all your data. So
do you think, I mean, there might be an issue between, like with Facebook too, they tend to switch, you know, on their terms of services, especially on their privacy, it really seems they sort of move the ball around. Whereas, you know, on Amazon and Twitter, you know, from my interactions, it seems like a lot of their functions, you know, it's pretty consistent when you sign up for Amazon what it's going to do. And Twitter is pretty consistent. You know, they pretty much lay out, you know, what their expectations are, what your expectations are, and what you can do to ensure your privacy. Whereas I think the large issue with Facebook is that, you know, whenever they want to sort of monetize a service or, you know, push out more advertising, they sort of change the terms of service, and they do it in such a way that's, you know, largely considered negative and sort of surreptitious and sort of, you know, I hate to use the word sneaky, but I mean, you know, would you say that it's, you know, it almost, the point that you're making almost seems to be, you know, it's up to the individual, you know, to make a decision on how to be anonymous, how not to be anonymous. And, you know, it's up to the individual and their choice. Or is, you know, is there really, you know, maybe a give and take, or it's really up to the individual, you know, because it's commercial services and you don't necessarily have to sign up.
Right. I think, you know, the individual, it has to take personal responsibility for all of it. And I think we have to assume that whatever Facebook commits to today doesn't mean that's what they're going to commit to tomorrow or the next day or the next day. And I also think a lot of us are in for surprises when they become even more creepy. Like when they reveal whose page you were looking at and which links you clicked on and which photos you dwelt on the longest. And then they start to form conclusions based on that and market to you based on that and market to your friends based on that. And it's just getting creepier and creepier. And I think we all just have to kind of understand that, you know, whatever we do, they're watching. It's worse than Big Brother. Big Brother never, you know, it's the corporate world. It's not our own government. It really should be scaring us all.
So I'm curious then, you know, with the state and the federal government, sort of how should a state, you know, let me frame this two ways. How does a state, you know, approach big data? I mean, you made the point that, you know, there was a, you know, somebody hacked a state database, but, you know, do you think there should be more sort of cooperation between the state and the federal governments, you know, a sort of syncing of standards between how data should be handled, or, you know, what should be the approach, you know, what is the approach now and what should be an approach, you know, to safeguard sort of, you know, data stored at the state level and sort of data stored at the federal level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely believe that leaders in the states need to be held accountable. And the way they're held accountable right now is not really by the federal government in any way, it's by the electors. So for the federal government to hold them accountable, they would have to find some way of issuing regulations saying, if you accept federal money, you must do the following when it comes to securing your IT. And maybe that's an approach. I would be so opposed to that in the commercial world, because the federal government has never, ever, ever proven that it can secure information as good as the commercial world. So it kind of chill runs up my spine when I hear of the federal government thinking of creating standards for the commercial world when they're as bad or worse than anyone when it comes to securing data. But maybe even worse than the federal world is the states. So maybe we could see a role for the federal government issuing security standards to the state governments, or at least coordinating on them. And I'm not a very political animal, but the governor of South Carolina, Haley, is that the right name? What's her name?
Nikki Haley, I think.
Nikki Haley. She said something like, in the aftermath of this massive security breach, she said something like, "Well, this happens more and more frequently these days," which to me was a very lame response. It was like, "Well, it's not my fault. Somebody hacked us." What I think should happen is people like that should either be extremely regretful and be seeking dramatic change and contrite in front of the public, or they should be canned. Now, it's not so easy to can a governor, but to me, it was a very lame response, as if, it's okay to be hacked. No, there's steps that could have been taken to prevent that. And in this big data world, we need more leaders that understand, our personal privacy is at risk and it's important to individuals. And it's very costly for individuals when your personal information is leaked. So that was my thoughts on that.
You know, it's great. So let's sort of switch gears to, what are the limitations of big data? In terms of analysis, in terms of use, you could pick, what you see as limitations, but I'm curious because, the tendency seems to be, more data is a good thing, but, that really, strikes me as a limitation. But, what is you, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, what are the, real big limitations of, looking at the world through the lens of big data, big analysis, et cetera?
I tell you, let me tell you a strength and a limitation, because I think the strength is getting all of the data together. Just more data is good, and more in the same location is good. That's a very strong positive thing, because that's how you can ask bigger questions and create new knowledge. So more data is good. What is bad right now today is it takes teams of very smart people, engineers, and Java developers and mathematicians and statisticians to analyze that data and create the knowledge from it. Now, end users are also in that data, and there's an old saying in the computer business, let everybody party on the data. Really, everybody should be able to party on the data. So the gap right now in my mind is there's not enough tools for users to party on the data. We need the user analytical tools that let individual analysts working in companies and government agencies to make maximum use of all the data, so they don't have to go through the IT department and ask the statisticians and others to program and run the queries for them. So that's
So,
my view on a strength and a gap.
I mean, would you say that sort of, I mentioned Google, I previously mentioned Google, I mean, but, to sort of, to create more access, do you think, sort of the approach should be, more open source, or do you think it's more, through an API that's, can be, accessed with, very little programming skills? I mean, how would we sort of take your idea and sort of deploy it, in a wider environment? Because I mean, I'm not critiquing or anything. I'm just saying that sort of, I do understand it, and you made a really good point, actually.
For me, it's about finding best of breed tools and putting them in organizations. I focus a lot on federal kind of organizations, but this applies to companies too. So if there's a commercially available tool that you can buy, and install it and give that to analysts and workers just through their desktop, that's a good way to do it, because it does require some work in the back end where the IT guys have to configure this tool to touch all of the data. But then the user just has to open a web browser and they get this tool. And examples of those tools are, there's a company called Datamere, which was very early on in this big data revolution. And so Datamere produced something that gives users a very familiar interface. You know, it looks like a spreadsheet, but it's tapping into all these big data resources. And then you see dashboards. Or Thetis is another one. Thetis gives users a way to interact with big data through beautiful interfaces, and a way to manipulate using your mouse and keyboard. Even though you're a user, you don't have to learn all the computer science, but you can interact with all the data. IBM famously has been working in this big data world for a long time, and they bought a company about a year ago called Analyst Notebook. Analyst Notebook is maybe the most widely deployed analytical tool in the world. Every police department has it and uses it to map out the bad guys, and every police department, law enforcement agency, military agency, government has Analyst Notebook. And now they have made that even more user-friendly. And with the IBM strengths, they plug that into all of the big data databases of the enterprise. MarkLogic is another one. MarkLogic deploys things to the server and then make it easy for developers to write applications. So the application a user sees is not called MarkLogic, but maybe it was developed with MarkLogic. And this is a favorite topic, as you can probably tell. I could do this all day. I love these companies. And I think that kind of tool is what the user is going to face and what's going to help the user interact with big data.
So do you think – I was thinking about this, you know, in the course of, you know, your explanation. Do you think, like, TwitChimp – like, I've noticed, like, through using it, you know, this is, you know, the – I want to call it a product that you've sort of developed. You know, I've noticed that, you know, TwitChimp, like, it does give us, you know, has made organizing the information flows on Twitter very much, you know, easier and more concise. I mean, I think, you know, if we were to approach Twitter as a big data problem, you know, you follow 2,000 people and you have 2,000, you know, conversations going on in your feed, you know, I find that, you know, TwitChimp and sort of, you know, other organizational services, you know, mostly, you know, I would argue that it's mostly, you know, the most organization for Twitter is, you know, either through third-party clients like TweetDeck or, you know, on the phone it would be TweetCaster and TweetBot. You know, it seems like, you know, the biggest thing, you know, a third party could bring, or any party really, is organization and the ability and sort of, you know, ease of use. You know, is that something that, you know, companies are aiming for, sort of, you know, to your point, to make it, you know, more accessible to everybody, you know, who don't necessarily have, a lot of computer skills or a lot of sort of programming knowledge?
Right. And so thanks for mentioning TwitChimp. You know, it's a way of curating. So it's a way of having human beings select and say, here's a list of who I think are important people to follow on Twitter. So in that way, it's a way of narrowing down the Twitter stream, that fire hose, into digestible chunks. You know, our common friend Alex Olesker has produced several lists. One of his lists, for example, is on the national security, and you can see the top 22 national security folks he recommends that you follow. Or he has another on federal technology blogs and or federal tech experts. And so it's a way of narrowing down into curated list on a variety of topics. I never thought of it quite as a big data solution. I do want this to be of use to people in helping them understand and create knowledge. So maybe I should start thinking of it in that big data kind of context. And I appreciate you making me, you're forcing my thoughts like that.
Oh, sorry. No, I mean, like, for instance, you know, the more I think about it, you know, the most, you know, the biggest data set that, you know, I as an individual have most interaction with is Twitter. And the fact that, you know, the more I think about how I use Twitter, it's, you know, it's the HTML, the website Twitter, and then, you know, clients like TweetDeck, TweetBot, and then TweetCaster. And, you know, most of those clients are on my phone. And so it's really interesting that the interplay between sort of, you know, the computer and the mobile, you know, so the PC and the mobile, but then also, you know, how much emphasis is really on sort of organizing the blast from the fire hose. I mean, it seems like, you know, for instance, you know, I have a list for, you know, national security people, and then I have a list for, you know, particularly just Iran, you know, and then Afghanistan, Syria, and then sort of, then I have three or four sort of infosec lists, you know, people who do cryptology, people who do white hat, you know, white hat, people who do black hat stuff. You know, it's really like it seems like Twitter really does put a premium on, you know, on the same things that you would see in any sort of big data project, which is, you know, to me, it seems organization, accessibility, and, you know, being able to understand the data that's, you know, streaming in and coming through and sort of hopefully, you know, putting a context or sort of analysis to that data. But I don't know. Those are just my sort of random thoughts on, you know, using Twitter for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, and I think I appreciate these thoughts because it's making me think of Twitter in new expansive ways, and also making me think these big data tools that I talked about, and I listed off a bunch of them for the enterprise, there's really very few for the individual right now. But you think of the day when, you know, this thing from IBM called Watson, you know, Watson famously, you know, won Jeopardy. So
right.
That's where it became famous. I saw, you know, they have a deployable version of Watson now. It's much dumber, but they deploy it to conferences. And so you can go to a tech conference and you can play Jeopardy with Watson. Still, it's big. Well, what about, I'm sure in just a few years, they're going to have the capability of Watson that will fit on your smartphone or your smart device. So it's going to be able to help you digest the massive stream of Twitter coming into your smartphone and your other feeds too, your LinkedIn feeds and your Facebook feeds. I'm not sure if IBM's planning that or not, but someone should, because we need those tools to digest this information.
Well, I mean, could you argue that Siri, you know, Apple Siri is sort of, you know, the dumber Watson? I don't know what the, you know, appropriate references, but it seems like on the iPhone, Siri sort of kind of fulfills that function. I mean, it's a very primitive sort of fulfillment, because, you know, it's you have to ask her, and it's not adaptive, and it's not, you know, generally she gives you the wrong response, at least in my experience.
Yeah.
But
yeah, maybe that's where Siri's evolving to. And I also think that if you are building any capability, any enterprise anywhere, and you're building your own natural language connection into your capability, you should stop that now and just find a way to build into Siri. Use Siri's API or something similar instead of creating your own. So that's one point. And also, as Siri continues to improve, let's just imagine the world 2 years from now when it really does get good. Maybe that is where you just say to Siri, what tweets should I listen to, or which show me the tweets that I would be interested in.
That's really interesting. So for our last part of our conversation, let's talk about the future of big data. You know, we've already sort of mentioned the mobile market, and I'm curious, you know, if we'll see sort of a larger involvement of mobile devices and sort of being able to draw from and sort of use, you know, big data sets. And, you know, what is the future for, you know, enterprise solutions? What is the future for government big data, if any, you know?
Yeah. So there's some things I hope are in the future, but I haven't seen much movement yet. And then some things I see movement in that are just really making me incredibly optimistic. So let me tell you one I hope to see, but I don't see it yet. I wish there was a big data solution that would help us with traffic. Like so many other people, I hate wasting my time in traffic. Don't you?
Yeah, I do.
And, so the good thing about traffic is it gives people an opportunity to listen to your podcast.
That's true. Hopefully.
But that's like the only good thing about it, because I mean, we all waste time, we waste productivity. There's stress on us as individuals. It's costly. You know, you could be somewhere else having fun. In some locations, I have seen work being done with big data to help communities organize smarter and also to route traffic smarter. And in the DC Beltway area here, the only thing they've really done with it is they put up warning signs and say, you know, congestion to mile marker 158. And it's like, well, I already knew that.
right.
But you do see some smart things like the use of movement data on cell phones being theoretically anonymized and brought back to Google, and it shows you on Google Maps where the high traffic areas are, even though there's not a sensor around. In other countries, like I saw a documentary from Japan, they're using data on traffic in a far more useful way and helping to plan better roads and helping to remove locations where there's – or change locations where there's more traffic accidents and incidents. And so one in the I wish for category would be big data solutions that help with traffic. But let me tell you one that I see that's just – really exciting, and maybe the most virtuous I've run across is big data solutions associated with health and bioinformatics. Health is something that should concern every single one of us. Now, maybe I'm more concerned now that I'm getting older and grayer, but really everybody should have a concern with health. All of us have had relatives that have come down with a horrible disease, or we, you know, read the news and it's just so traumatic, and all of us will face health issues one day. And there's so much data associated with health now, and there are big data solutions right now that are bringing this information together and creating new knowledge that's resulting in ways we can change our lifestyle and behavior and ways we can treat diseases. Let me give you just one of many, many examples. The National Institutes of Health funds the National Cancer Institute. They have been funding research for years into ways to fight cancer and cancer treatments. There's a whole genetic atlas of cancer-associated genes. They have just this year, I mean, well, in 2012, their Frederick National Lab created a capability to bring together the unstructured research of, you know, cancer research libraries and that structured world of the genome in a way to correlate information between individual genes and cancers in people. And that's going to be a very powerful research tool for researchers that I know is going to give us more breakthroughs in the right way, best way to treat cancers. So that's one of a very long list of great breakthrough research projects associated with big data.
That's very cool. That's very awesome. So as we sort of draw the conversation down, do you have anything else that we didn't hit on, or do you want to sort of bring up, or?
I would just say this. I would a word of caution from a technologist viewpoint, and that is there's a danger that this term big data is about to lose all of its meaning. And what I mean is this. Years ago, a technologist you'd read the word SOA, service-oriented architecture. It's a very cool concept. And then web services in the technology world came along, and it allowed organizations to create service-oriented architectures. And for me as a tech guy, that was just awesome. It's a smart way to do things. You write a program and you decouple the data from that program, and you even decouple the interface from that program. You use a service-oriented architecture. Well, it became a buzzword. Every company in the world started to use the word SOA differently, and it lost all meaning. Then we saw a similar thing with cloud computing. For me, cloud computing was a very specific approach to designing computational systems. It was proudly rolled out and used by Amazon in their, I mean, they're pioneers in cloud computing. And then every company in the world started using that as a buzzword, and the term lost so much of its meaning. Now we're seeing that with big data. Big data to me means doing things in new, exciting ways and asking bigger questions and creating new knowledge over all the data. But every company in the world is starting to use that term on their own. And if we're not careful and don't use discipline, it's going to lose all its meaning. And that was my thought.
Well, thank you so much. This was really an enlightening conversation. I hope that, you know, the Loopcast listeners sort of, you know, learn something or take something away from it. So just remember to check out CTO Vision and TwitChimp, which I'll put the links up, and you know, you can go explore, you know, look at sort of the great stuff that Bob is doing and his company is doing. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Oh, thanks.